It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk with the founder of a website that provides do-it-yourself plans and ideas for people living with disabilities to make their lives easier and better. And we hear from the woman who inspired the project.
First, a new study from UW-Milwaukee found that the percentage of women who smoke while pregnant is significantly higher in Wisconsin than in the rest of the country.
That rate fell dramatically starting around 1990, but for the last 10 years, the rate has stayed stagnant at about 13 or 14%. Researchers saying there's not really a clear explanation as to why the rate is higher in Wisconsin than the country at large. Joining us now is WPR reporter Hope Kerwin, who covered the story. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, can you give these numbers some context? So we're looking at a 14% rate of smoking while pregnant in Wisconsin, 9% across the country. Are the researchers seeing this as a really significant difference, a significant problem here in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think the gap between the numbers is what is significant. I think it's really the fact that this progress has kind of seemed to stall in Wisconsin. So, you know, a majority of that decline, as you said, happened between 1990 and 2003. And ever since 2003, over the last decade, you know, it's really seemed to kind of stay at that 14%. And, you know, this research is based on birth certificate data. So it's really hard to you know, figure out why we're not making progress here in Wisconsin.
And what, as you understand it, are some of the health repercussions of maternal smoking?
Right. So babies born to women who smoke are, you know, they're twice as likely to have low birth rate, which can lead to decreased lung function and brain development. There's also twice the mortality rate for those babies. And, you know, it can also lead to things like sudden infant death syndrome. And, you know, there are women who smoke during pregnancy are also more likely to have a miscarriage.
How did the study track whether women were smoking during pregnancy or not here in the state?
Right. So, like I said, it's birth certificate data. So it's taken for every live birth between 1990 and 2013. And that data is also self-reported, which I think is something that's interesting to look at because, you know, there is a possibility that women who have, you know, poor birth outcomes could have underreported their smoking during pregnancy.
You spoke to one of the UW-Milwaukee researchers, epidemiologist Karen Palmer-Scheim. Let's give a little listen to some of what she had to say.
There's a positive correlation between level of educational attainment and occupational category. So that's part of what we're seeing. And so there's social norms, again, if you will, that are associated with people based on where they live and where they work.
So what kind of differences did they see when it comes to education levels and types of occupation?
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Palmer-Scheim said that actually education was the strongest indicator for whether a woman will smoke during pregnancy. They found that women with a high school education or less were 14 times more likely to smoke than women who have a college degree. And even women with some college education were 8 times more likely to smoke than women with a college degree. And, you know, Dr. Palmer-Scheim talked about how, you know, education, there's a positive correlation with you know, your job status and what type of job you end up working. And a lot of times women in the hotel industry or the restaurant industry, you know, that work leads to, it has been shown to lead to picking up smoking.
Talking to WPR reporter Hope Kerwin, she's looking at some new UW-Milwaukee research on smoking rates among pregnant women here in Wisconsin. About 14% of pregnant women smoking apparently in the state with negative birth outcomes, health outcomes for their children. Any other demographic variation, any other groups more likely to smoke during pregnancy, Hope?
Absolutely. The study found that women 18 to 24 also were more likely to smoke during pregnancy. They also found that significantly American Indian and Alaskan Native women, more of those women reported smoking during pregnancy, that 40% actually, which is, you know, huge compared to the next racial group, which were Black women at 17%. And that's also 40% for American Indians. That's twice as high as the national average. So that group was pretty significant. They also found that women living in the top, you know, the northern third of the state tended to have higher, that those counties tended to have higher prevalences of smoking during pregnancy.
As I understand it, Hope, there is a state-led effort to try to bring the smoking rate down among pregnant women. What's going on at the state level?
Right. So the Wisconsin Women's Health Foundation has a free program for smoking cessation for pregnant women called First Breath. And the idea of that program is to offer it during, typical prenatal care so that it's not an extra thing that women will have to do, that they can receive that, smoking cessation help and resources and support during their regular prenatal care visits. And in talking with the people at First Breath, they talked a lot about how poverty is kind of an underlying factor a lot of times for women who smoke during pregnancy, that, women in poverty tend to have really high levels of stress and that smoking becomes a coping mechanism for them. And, that makes it that much harder to quit.
Do they have programs in place to help pregnant women quit smoking?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this First Breath program already is helping over 1,000 women every year in Wisconsin. And, the people I talk to, they're hoping to expand that number because, there are a lot more women in Wisconsin who smoke during pregnancy and really just offering, they talked about how telling a woman to stop smoking during pregnancy is not enough, that the education is there, that people know that it's not help. It's harmful for their child, but having the resources to stop smoking, to stop the addictive behavior, is difficult to come by. So that's what they're hoping to improve upon: is more resources, more support for those women.
As you mentioned, Hope, these levels have been stagnant for quite a while now, staying around that 14% mark, rate of women, pregnant women smoking in Wisconsin. Talking to the UW-Milwaukee researchers, talking to the people from this First Breath effort, did you get a sense of optimism that they think they have the tools in place to start bringing that rate down?
Well, the most optimistic statement that I found was that they're really hoping that this study will inform future smoking cessation programs for pregnant women, that they will be able to better target, whether it be the northern half of the northern third, of the state, or and really these counties that have significantly higher prevalence of smoking during pregnancy, making sure that the resources are available in those counties. But also really, targeting certain racial or age demographics that seem to, have higher rates.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Hope Kerwin telling us about a new study that found that pregnant women smoke at a higher rate in Wisconsin, talking about 14% is that rate, higher here in Wisconsin than the country as a whole. Right now, technology has advanced in a lot of areas, and there have been a lot of improvements in the tools available to people living with disabilities. But even when high-tech and often high-priced devices are available, they don't always meet the daily needs of people with disabilities.
Our next guests are applying do-it-yourself fixes and hacks to those problems through the Engineering at Home Project. Cindy is living with multiple disabilities as a result of complications from a catastrophic heart attack. Her DIY engineering to improve her quality of life is the inspiration for the Engineering at Home Project. Cindy, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And Katrin Lynch is a professor of anthropology at Olin College of Engineering in Massachusetts, and she's one of the creators of Engineering at Home. Katrin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
Well, Cindy, I want to start with you. Now, after your heart attack recovery, which included a double amputation, what particular challenges did you run into as you worked your way back into your daily life routines?
Well, my amputations involved both upper and lower limbs. So there are times when the compromised hands are a bigger problem than the amputated lower limbs. And most people who think of disabilities assume that the issues are lower limb, and the upper limb problems are often not addressed at all. Daily tasks became a totally new challenge, and I needed to find a way over and around those obstacles so that I could have some semblance of a normal daily life.
And it sounds as though, you know, you had excellent physical therapy, you had high-tech medical prosthetics, too. Why wasn't that enough for you?
Oh, I've been very lucky in having fabulous people involved in my care, but each person's story is different and each person's needs are different. And in some ways, the only person who knows what I need is me. And there is no central place that I know of to go to see what's available. It's a lot of catalog, a lot of online, but there isn't a medical supply store that has things that, you know, I could stand in front of and look and see what they have that might help me. So I had to kind of piece things together with the help of some other people to figure out how to do the things that I need to do to be as independent as possible, because obviously that's the goal, and to have more things on the can-do list than the can't-do list.
And I know that you took this do-it-yourself approach, which is very big these days. What are some of the things that you did to help yourself be able to meet the challenges that you had?
Well, I used to care what I look like, but very quickly what became most important was function and actually being able to do different things. So one of my favorite things that I figured out was if I put a peel-and-stick hook available at the drugstore on a cart of, you know, 12, onto the top of a jar of cream on my night table, I could pick it up by that hook where I couldn't get my hand around the whole jar. And that would obviously work for people who had weak hands from a stroke or people who have bad arthritis and whose fingers don't bend the way they need to pick up a jar. But with the hook on top, it's totally doable, and that could go on peanut butter jar or anything else as well.
And did you come up with that on your own and some of your other ideas, or did you have kind of source material that you were drawing from?
No, it was totally, this is something I need to do, and what can I think of to make it possible for me to do it so I didn't have to ask for even more help? So I thought, you know, what do I have? What would make it work? How could I do this? Just really the need is what was the impetus for the fix. But I'm not clever, and they are very simple things. My husband put cable ties on all of the drawer pulls so I could open, you know, any drawer I need to mm-hmm. get into. Very easy, cheap, simple, but totally makes a difference. I use tongs to eat a sandwich or a hamburger, something like that, which looks a little bit odd, but it enables me to pick up and put down a sandwich, which is very difficult with my hand.
And Katrin, I want to bring you in on this too, because Cindy is a big part of the inspiration for Engineering at Home. Why did what she was doing inspire you?
Thanks very much. Yeah, even listening to Cindy right now reminds me of why my colleague Sarah Hendren and I wanted to work with Cindy to share her work. So our website is an archive that uses Cindy's example to reach an audience of people. We both teach at an engineering college, Olin College of Engineering. We want our engineering students as well as others to think in new ways about what counts as engineering, what counts as adaptive and assistive technology, what counts as prosthetics. So we created this resource, which is, here's Cindy's examples, here's some stories behind where she got these ideas, and let's think in new ways about where we get ideas from and who is empowered to be creating and to be coming up with ideas. So Cindy's very modest. She says things like, I'm not clever. They're very simple things. But it's precisely the simplicity and the fact that they're so life-transforming for her that is what we love in the example, right? We don't need to think of, you know, the most high-tech innovations to be transformative for people's lives. And Cindy also is an example, provides an example for people of, you know, think about what you yourself can do. Look at your own environment in a new way. Cindy, you know, sees a peel-and-stick hook that you might hang something lightweight on your wall. She sees that and sees an opportunity for opening jars. And she sees a zip tie as something she can open drawers with. So reframing and re-seeing the world is such a great way for us to train engineers, to get engineers to think in new ways.
And Cindy, one of the things that's so cool about what you did is that you just said, you know, I could really use something to eat a sandwich or open a jar, and you built it yourself. And Katrin, looking at engineering at home, is that part of what's inspiring about this, is that, you know, you don't have to have an engineering degree. You can be empowered to build what you need and to rethink about who exactly can do this.
It's true. We talk, my colleague Sarah and I talk about, you know, let's look around and look for makers everywhere, right? But we also want this to be considered legitimate engineering, right? Like our dream is to both to help people to think about the maker movement as really having impact beyond just like, oh, that was cool, this thing I made, but also to bring engineering back into a history of engineering that was more about, you know, about, you know, it doesn't have to be the latest material science or the latest robotics, but can be things that are inspired by craft and assembly and appropriating from the world around you. So to think of that legitimately also as engineering. Like if our engineering students could see this website and other engineering students could see this website and think, that has something to do with why I wanted to become an engineering. Real impact on people, real impact partnering with the people you're trying to create things for, do it together with the people you're designing among, and really to just change the dynamic around engineering and design.
We're talking right now with Katrin Lynch, the founder or creator of Engineering at Home, and also talking with Cindy, who invented a lot of this engineering that we're talking about, an inspired engineering at home. And Katrin, would you say that Cindy's beginning there and what you've built on, has it changed the way people think about engineers and what they can do?
Well, the website's new. We just released it 2 months ago, although we've had thousands of people look at it, which has been wonderful. I think, you know, it resonates with people who already, you know, we're preaching to the converted, people who already know about the importance of co-design, of design for one, of the importance of low-tech for high, often low-tech for high impact. So we are trying to reach, you know, a wide audience of people who might not yet have thought about the ways in which prosthetics themselves can be defined as more everyday, adaptive, low-tech, where appropriate. So we're hoping it'll have a large impact, and we know that, you know, just from feedback we've gotten on our website, lots of people are saying, you know, that they themselves have been building things to adapt their own world, but they hadn't really framed what they were doing in these ways, so that seems to be meaningful to a number of people.
And Cindy, how did you feel having done this stuff? Because I can imagine coming out of what you went through after your heart attack, there's a lot to learn, but to know that you could tackle some of this stuff and create what you needed, as you said, you needed it and you built it. How did that change the way you felt about yourself?
Well, it was awesome. I mean, any triumph is huge when you're starting as far back as I was. And, you know, any task I could accomplish myself without having to ask anybody else to help with yet another thing, it was just awesome. I just wish there were more, and I wish other people who were figuring out these clever workarounds would, you know, email me so I could share in what they've figured out. It would be nice to have a clearinghouse for that, because I'm sure other people have good ideas that would be helpful to me. I just don't know what they are. But it anything that is makes something easier than it used to be, or possible when it wasn't possible at all, is a huge triumph. And the daily things are the biggest obstacles.
And Katrin, as we wrap up, what do you want people to know about engineering and what it means to work together and have a sort of DIY aesthetic about making stuff?
Well, we think about that it's really important for us to think about engineering in terms of addressing human needs. We're at a point right now where, like, as we think about the next generation of engineering prosthetics, let's not only think about high-tech innovation and technology, but let's think about, like, engaging with people like Cindy so we hear multiple voices and lots of kinds of expertise. So we think that, you know, engineering is all around us. The maker movement's around us. Let's frame engineering as all around us so we can start to have more creative solutions and solutions that have high impact in assistive and adaptive technology and also in all sorts of ways that engineers are trying to make a positive difference in people's lives.
Katrin, thank you so much for joining us. And Cindy, I want to thank you too.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Cindy and Katrin Lynch. And Katrin Lynch is the creator of the Engineering at Home website, which she helped to create.
Malia Obama made waves this week when the White House announced she'd be attending Harvard University after she graduates from high school, but not right away. She plans to take a gap year before she joins Harvard in the class of 2021.
So what is a gap year? Do they serve a purpose for all students, or are they only an option for wealthy students? Well, joining us now to explain the gap year is Ethan Knight. He's the executive director and founder of the American Gap Association. Ethan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Ethan, to start out, how do you define what a gap year is?
Well, we define a gap year as an experiential semester or year on, and we're doing the Richard Nixon quotes here to define on, because it's not a year off. It's really a time to engage. What we say is most students do it between their freshman year of college and their senior year of high school, and it's intended to basically deepen personal, practical, and professional awareness for your future.
What are some of the things people tend to do during that gap year if they're using it not as a year off, but as you say, a year on?
Yeah, it really ranges. I mean, I've seen students volunteer with animal rehabilitation centers in Bolivia. I've seen students focus on a program in Montana, for instance, that works with outdoor adventure activities and a little bit of personal development.
Now, I can see some parents being a little worried that, sure, if my kid takes one of these gap years, they're going to, you know, not want to go back. That'll be it, and they won't want to go to college. Does that happen?
You know, it happens, but probably no more so, or I guess probably certainly less so than the average high school graduate. Our data right now that we have, and Malia Obama's announcement actually came quite serendipitously because we had just completed our big 2015 National Alumni Survey and found that 90% of students are back at college within a year of completing their gap year, and that was corroborated by a few other studies that had been done before by Carl Hagler and Ray Nelson.
One concern a lot of people point to about the gap year is that it's something that's really available to a certain, maybe more privileged group of people, people who can afford to have a year unpaid off between high school and college. Is it really limited that much, or are more people able to do something like this?
It's a great question. It's not really limited that way. I think there are programs that are available for young people who do have more resources. What I'll also say, though, is in that same study that we did, I guess another one, we found that almost $3 million were given away by programs, but you have to ask the program. They're sort of sourced internally as a scholarship. But that being said, a lot of students are taking a gap year in a more independent fashion. If you're looking to do a gap year, for instance, AmeriCorps has NCCC, which actually pays for you to live, and then at the end of it gives you a what they call a Siegel Award, which is just over $5,700 to go towards your academic future. So there's a variety of programs that are available, and you know, honestly, a lot of organizations are really working to add more financial aid resources to their offerings so that they can increase the diversity on programs.
So it seems as though we've been talking more and more about gap years over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. Is it just because of Malia, or is there really something happening that this is taking off in this country?
I'd like to say it's taking off. You know, I think Malia Obama certainly propelled us forward probably several years in terms of our growth trajectory. But students have been asking about gap years forever. You know, not forever, but in the UK, 30% of students are taking a gap year. We estimate 1 to 2% are taking a gap year here in the U.S. Our own data shows 23% increase in the number of students who are taking a gap year between last year and 2015. I guess 2014 and 2015 is what the data shows.
Talking to Ethan Knight from the American Gap Association, looking at the concept of the gap year, a year off between leaving high school and starting college, a year not really off, though, he says, a year doing some kind of experience, life-enhancing experience. So, Ethan, let's take that student now. They're a high school senior. They've been through the gap year. What benefits do they get as a college student? How does that help them?
Students are graduating on time, more typically. Our recent survey said that students are graduating, an average within 4 years at their college. I think fundamentally, though, you could talk about GPA, which is improved. You could talk about academic involvement, which is improved. But at the end of the day, I think fundamentally what's so powerful about the gap year is it provides an opportunity before you have to start accruing college debt, before you have to start picking a major and choosing some sort of career decisions, to really reflect and say, what do I want to do? I like to think about it as an opportunity to nibble around the edges of a potential career, and so that by the time you're done with your gap year, you have a deeper sense of who you are and what you want to define as success for you. I think most young people wouldn't be able to tell you what their definition of success is. They'd probably, do as best as they're able to share maybe their parents' definition or that of their peers or maybe what they pick up in the media. Quite frankly, when I speak at high schools, the most common answer is, some gesticulation with fingers rubbing together that involve, basically means money is the number one reason why, what they define as success. And when I challenge that, I tend to get a lot of blank faces. They just haven't really put the time or thought into it. And one of the things that I like to think about is, in our culture, we have this process, this college application process, which for many is as close to a rite of passage as they'll have in any other semblance of their life, where it's the first time they've really taken a look back at their life and are having to present who they are and what they're about to an outside person. And a gap year really just adds a whole fifth dimension to that experience of that rite of passage.
We hear a lot about how school these days is really stressful. There's a lot of testing. It's high stakes. Kids can be really overprogrammed, especially as they head into those later college year or high school years where they feel like they really have to get it together and put a good college portfolio together. Do you think that's part of it, that students are a little burned out by the time they graduate?
The data would say yes. The two most prominent reasons that our research are showing that students are taking a gap year are number one, a desire to know more about themselves, which I think speaks to that rite of passage element. And then secondarily is burnout from the competitive pressures of getting into college. And I think the stakes are just perceived to be so high for the college that you get into that oftentimes it's more about, how you can present yourself rather than who you really are. And I think, college admissions representatives, I think Rick Weisbord from the Harvard School of Graduate Education recently wrote a report called the Turning the Tide Report that was really an attempt to draw the circle more around, less around sort of academic achievement. Not that that should be excluded, but more about character, who you are, the compassion and the caring that goes into your fellow human.
What do colleges and universities think of a gap year? Because I could see anything from, great, we're getting students after they've had this year, they're better rounded, their priorities are more set, ranging from there to, great, all these slackers procrastinating for a year. What are you seeing from the world of higher education?
Well, it's funny. The schools who have the lower acceptance rates, I think they have the luxury to be able to sort of delay a student for a year from their perspective to take a gap year. It's really the more public institutions that I think it's more a lack of the sort of the ability. It's a lack of manpower, I think, is really what it is to say, okay, you're going to do something other than the quote-unquote normal pathway here. And so by and large, schools are typically saying, we really like it. And increasingly what I'm seeing, for instance, there's a school out of Asheville, North Carolina, Warren Wilson College. They have a scholarship set up that's for $16,000 for a student who has completed a gap year. They call it a leadership scholarship because they know that a student who's taken a gap year is going to perform that much better both academically and within the overall structure of the student body. There's another school, Florida State University, that just recently announced $50,000 in $5,000 scholarships are going to students to encourage them to go take a gap year. In essence, what they say is, apply to Florida State, tell us you're going to take a gap year, and we'll give you $5,000 to go take that gap year.
Are there a lot of scholarships like that, or are those still kind of the exceptions?
Those are still the exceptions. What I'm seeing is an increase in the number of those exceptions. We hope to make them more exceptional and less of an exception.
For people who aren't necessarily college-bound, are things like that AmeriCorps project you mentioned or other things available so that they do something maybe before they meet that necessity of finding that job out of high school?
It's interesting because we are seeing an increase in the offerings of programs that are more, I guess you could call them vocational exploration. And I think, you know, in the gap year community, I'd be surprised if you hear everyone say that college is the exact destination for everyone to go. I think by and large, we can definitely say college has some very significant upsides and pretty much everyone should do it. But that being said, I still think you're going to see a lot more students in the future who are going to choose a more vocational pathway. And so the opportunity to explore what that might look like it's a really phenomenal opportunity that takes a little bit of coaching, a little bit of guidance, but frankly, you kind of have to, you know, experiment. It's like, try and then fail and then try and fail and hopefully eventually you find something that you love. Case in point, there was a student group that I had a couple years ago. They were down in Guatemala and a hurricane had come through. A student ended up supporting some of the local homestay families that they were there. The student was fine, got to say that. But as a result of that experience, the student found very clearly that they wanted to be a firefighter. They had never explored that possibility before, but eventually came to clarity that that was what they wanted to do. And sure enough, at the end of the program, chose to go pursue firefighting, which is, I can't think of a more laudable career.
We're talking right now with Ethan Knight about gap years and why it might be beneficial for students to take them. Malia Obama made headlines this week for her decision to take a gap year before starting Harvard University in 2017.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Did you or your kid take this gap year between high school and college, or is this a conversation you're having right now about next year's school year or maybe non-school year? Do you think they're maybe only available for wealthier families? Is it something that you wish you had access to? Do you have a question for our guest about what's out there, what kind of things people do with this year, and what the benefits and maybe drawbacks are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about gap years, the year some people take off between graduating high school and starting college. The White House announced this week that President Obama's oldest daughter, Malia, will be taking that so-called gap year before starting school at Harvard.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Gap year, good idea, bad idea? Did you do it? Do you wish you'd done it? Are you talking about doing it right now if you're headed into college next year? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ethan Knight is with us now. He's the executive director and founder of the American Gap Association. And we go to our callers now. Andy joins us in Madison. Andy, hi. Hello, Andy. You're on the air. Nope. I am afraid we can't hear him. Maybe, Andy, call back when you've got some better reception. And Ethan, while we get some more callers on the line here, what kind of planning do you need to put into a gap year so you make sure that you're not just kind of couch surfing for a year?
Yeah, you know, most students start the process around the same time as they're looking at college. And frankly, the complexities shoot up quite significantly so if you're looking international. And one of the encouragement that we often offer is start with looking at a more structured program so that you can kind of have a few training wheels, a couple bumpers to make sure that you don't learn lessons too hard the hard way. You know, I think that the classic, you know, conundrum here is that you don't know what you don't know until someone teaches you. And so our encouragement is usually to start with more structure and work your way down to less. But in terms of planning, you know, I think it's a good idea. You should do it with parents. The student should lead the way. It needs to be experientially motivated. I think that's one of the core principles of a gap year is that it's experiential education. And then, you know, it's oftentimes important to look at budget and timelines. I think one of my favorite things to do is to think about it in terms of skills. What do you want to practice? Is there a hobby that could potentially be a career? Can you scaffold that on to somebody else who's already doing that and pick up what you can and then bring it back home and say, maybe I can parlay that into a career through college and for further study.
We'll go to a caller now with Philip in Racine. Philip, hi.
As a military a retiree and an educational retiree who has had two Fulbrights and several international experiences, I would like to generalize the gap year. I have found that high school graduates are perhaps at the most energetic and idealistic part of their lives, and many of them, as myself earlier, do not have a full grasp of what is ahead of them. And the idea of being able to volunteer for 2 years, whether it's Peace Corps or some other nonprofit entity, locally or abroad, to give them a chance to grow up, to meet other peoples and cultures, and have varied experiences, thus giving them an entitlement so that they have a better idea of what they're going to do and can be more direct in their career.
Philip, thanks so much. Interesting idea, Ethan. Philip says not one, but two gap years in effect, but let's have it be for some kind of nonprofit or volunteer service.
You know, it's interesting. There's a movement out there called the Service Year Alliance. It was formerly known as the Franklin Project. It's not a new idea to hit the States, but you know, certainly practiced in other parts of the world where the idea is between the ages of 18 to 28 to encourage a nationally endowed or at least supported year of service. I think it's something that has, it certainly has merit, and I'd love to see it get more traction.
And thanks to Philip for that call. Appreciate that. We're going to go to Tanya now in Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hi, this is Tanya.
And what did you want to share?
Oh, I just wanted to share that I have three children, and the first two did do that gap year. It gave them a chance to get out of the peer pressure, but that whole peer identity of high school. And when they got out on their own, they were able to shed some of that and get to know who they were as an individual, what their likes, what their dislikes were, what they were good at. It really just helped to clarify them, and like one went into medical, one went into engineering, and it just really streamlined their life and their choices. It also helped encourage them not to ever give up on college, because they certainly didn't want to do the job that they were doing for the rest of their lives. They wanted that degree. Our youngest one also went to college, and he's doing fine, but it took him a while to realize what he wanted to do, because he was still, you know, you go right from high school to college, you're still that, have that student mindset. You're not really thinking like with a grown-up head. And that was what I wanted to say.
Really interesting, Tanya. Thank you so much for sharing that. So there's an endorsement, Ethan, for a gap year about getting out of sort of the peer bubble and thinking like an adult, learning how to do that over the course of a year. Do you think that shift in thinking is something that typically happens?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think in many ways we build our identities based on the environments that we're surrounded by. And if you only know one or a few small environments, not to say that, you know, New York City is a small environment, but New York City relative to the rest of the world, that's a small environment. And so I think a large part of it, you know, the benefit that I see is looking out at the world and seeing how do they do this thing called life? What do they value? You know, Latin American culture oftentimes, and this is a gross sort of generalization, but values family over other types of, you know, maybe American values where it might be more about career or success in terms of financial terms. You know, the other thing, too, that I think about it in terms of is what this cultivates inside of us is a sense of resilience. You know, that's how I think as we look at how the human brain is wired, we're learning a lot more about neurodevelopment, neural pathways. And what we're learning is that human brains develop the most fully when we are running aground with stuff and actively grappling with things that are a struggle. And what will happen, you know, inevitably is that that's going to add to the clarity for which how you want to live your life. I love the comment of, you know, being very clear that she didn't, or her children didn't want to continue the jobs that they'd had before. They got a much clearer sense of what they wanted to get into.
Thanks, Tanya. We're talking about the gap year between high school and college with Ethan Knight from the American Gap Year Association. Back to our callers with Andy in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. I'm the chairman of a board of a small not-for-profit. I'm a provider of gap year experiences. I work with an organization called Amigos de las Americas. And we work with Tufts right now, and they have a gap year experience. I think Tufts is now mandating a gap year experience for all of their students, which I think is what a phenomenal shift that comment that I wanted to make was that I think a lot of us have heard about helicopter parenting and parents that have so taken care of their children that their children aren't really quite prepared to deal with the real world. And I firmly believe that the gap year experience is an antidote to that and really helps mature our young adults.
Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Ethan, as we wrap up, some advice to consider for maybe that parent and that kid out there thinking about the gap year.
Well, I think it's certainly worth exploring. You know, I think there's the best thing that I could encourage you to do is sit down and have a conversation with the parents. You know, as I said before, sitting down and recognizing that the student needs to lead the way. I can't count the number of times I've had parents say that they really want their children to do a gap year, but you know, the student, maybe because the parent is saying it's something worth exploring, chooses to look the other way. And oftentimes, you know, just because a student goes on to their freshman year in college doesn't mean that they can't take a break, which is what I did, take a leave of absence between freshman year and sophomore year to take a gap year.
Ethan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Certainly. It's my pleasure, and thanks for this important topic.
Talking to Ethan Knight there. He's the executive director and founder of the American Gap Year Association. He joined us to talk about gap years after the news that Malia Obama is going to take a year off before starting at Harvard. You can still share your thoughts and maybe your experiences with the gap year over at the Central Time Facebook page. I want to go back and take a gap year now.
I might have done that as well. It was not a thing when I went to college. I don't think anybody did that.
Yeah, I don't think it ever came up.
Some people took a middle of it, but I don't know if that's quite the same thing.
So anyway, I'm taking a gap year now. I'll be back with you on Central Time May 5th, 2017. Okay, not really. Well, anyway, again, share your thoughts on the gap year. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and find out more from our guest organization, the American Gap Year Association. Every now and then, a company releases a life-changing product that we didn't know we needed until we got it. Think, you know, sliced bread, the personal computer, or the smartphone.
Well, now the KFC fast food chain has added to that list with the release of chicken-flavored lickable nail polish, currently available only in the Hong Kong market.
This nail polish, it comes in two colors/flavors. There's original flavor, and it's sort of beige-ish, and then there's red, which is, you know, hot and spicy chicken. It's made of edible ingredients, so you can, I guess, safely lick your fingernails all you want.
Something here from the KFC press release: simply apply and dry like regular nail polish, and then lick again and again and again to taste why the world's favorite chicken is finger-licking good.
So this is a thing, and I really spent some time searching for phrases like KFC nail polish hoax or scam. it's a real thing. There's actually a music video showing people dancing and periodically licking their fingers.
Only Hong Kong, which is interesting, but the comment sections were also interesting there because people are talking about, why would I want this? My dogs already lick my fingers. My dog's going to be following me around the house and being even more annoying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't even think of the whole pet angle. Mm-hmm. And there's the whole, like, I don't know if I want to pick up the habit of licking my fingers. Anyway, if you're lucky enough to be in Hong Kong, listening online, try it out. Let us know how it is. This is Central Time.